I want to read an announcement, first of all, to begin the sermon today. It's it's related to the In Accord that Mr. Franks did this week. So if you saw that In Accord production, know something of it. We need to look forward in terms of how things begin to morph or to change in the situation. So here's the announcement. It says, after almost a year of living under COVID-19 restrictions, new cases of the virus and infection rates have begun to dramatically decrease over the past 3 months in many areas throughout the country. Of course, it's not totally the same everywhere. There are 5 states, for example, that have had issues. In fact, they account for about half of the new cases and recent deaths just in 5 of the 50 states. Ohio is not one of them, thankfully. As a result, we believe it is time to begin relaxing these protocols where and when we can safely do so. So I will emphasize those points too. It is also appropriate for the church to have a unified, measured plan for returning to a normal, and that's in quotes, setting for our Sabbath services and other gatherings as a church. From the beginning of this pandemic, we desired to conduct Sabbath services in person in a safe environment, and the face covering and social distancing requirements came from that intent. We have deeply appreciated the cooperation of so many brethren through this period of time. Now, with input from the ministry and others, we have developed a process whereby pastors and congregations can move to safely relax COVID-19 restrictions as conditions improve in their areas. And we hope that that will apply through spring and summer for many areas. On Thursday, April the 8th, the church administration held a teleconference with all of the U.S. pastors to review this process and seek their input. In church areas where local government orders continue to require face coverings and other mitigation protocols, I would add such as here, current restrictions will need to continue for now. However, in areas that no longer mandate these requirements that show a steady decline or a plateau of both new cases and infection rates, pastors are asked to meet and consult with their local leadership to address the question and possible timing of relaxing current restrictions for their local Sabbath services. This process calls for the pastor to submit his plan with confirmation that his area meets the criteria to ministerial services for final approval. The final decision will rely heavily on the input of the pastor and the congregational leaders in each congregation. And I'm sure you can appreciate there is no way to do a one-size-fits-all to say on this particular Sabbath, you know, we'll do this across all the churches in the country. There's just no way to do that. I'm sure we can realize and understand. In congregations where a decision is made to relax protocols, the pastor will announce the change 1 week in advance. Since we fully realize that the effects of the virus will not simply be gone on one particular day, we encourage all of us to continue exercising care in our contact with one another at services and to realize that many members may still feel the need to wear a face covering and to social distance, meaning getting no closer than 6 feet for no more than 15 minutes. That's even once we get to a place where the local restrictions are lifted. It's still understood that we need to be patient and kind and understanding with each other in every way. Since this situation is still fluid, we must be prepared for potential changes based on conditions. Please note that if things change, for better or for worse, adjustments to the process will be made accordingly. We should be reminded that the Apostle Paul admonished church members about judging one another in Romans chapter 14. Of all people on earth, we, as God's people, should reflect such an attitude of doing what we can to avoid being a stumbling block to any of our brethren. Therefore, it is incumbent upon all of us to respect, love, and be patient with each other during this time of transition as we recover from this trying time for the world, our nation, and the church. We continue to deeply appreciate the patience and cooperation so many members have shown during this unique time in our history. In addition to this announcement, a special letter from CAGWA President Jim Franks will be distributed next week to further explain the process for relaxing COVID-19 restrictions. And Mr. Franks alluded to some of it on this week's In Accord, if you saw that production already. What I'd like to do, we actually have, the pastors have a four-page document with the process that we'll be following, which I have shared with our leadership teams just by email this morning, so some of them may not have even seen them yet. But there's a five-step process that we'll be undergoing as we come to a place where it seems that in our area things are changing. Now, that doesn't apply here yet, but we certainly hope we, you know, get to that stage. We would all want, I'm sure, sooner rather than later. But we will be closely monitoring things. The first step is that the pastor, and if need be, enlisting the aid of some of the local leadership, to go through some key questions like what are the state, county, municipal regulations in your area? Or we would add even facility regulations. For example, if the hall where a church meets, even if the surrounding area has lifted certain restrictions, if that hall that we're renting still has them in place, we will abide by them because that's just the way things need to be done. We have to go through and find our cases increasing, dropping, staying flat. What are some of the numbers involved? If they're increasing, are they spiking, or is it just kind of, you know, slight ups and downs? Level of positivity, we have to find all those things out. What do other groups in the area do? What are health professionals in the area recommending? What are the requirements of the facility? That's all part of step one. So those are the first things we do. Then step two, if it comes to the place where it seems like maybe it's possible, the second step, then we let our regional ministerial services team member know what our plans are. That's Mr. Welty in this case. The third step is to have a meeting. The pastor calls a meeting with the leadership team to fully discuss things, get everybody's input. Here's the information we have. Here's what we're thinking of doing. Here are the regulations. Here are the numbers. And we get everyone's input on a local leadership level. So that's the third step. And it says under this one, keep in mind our primary concern is for the health and safety of the brethren in cases where the pastor is recommending a change. So that's why we get the buy-in of all the leadership as well, get their thoughts as well. The fourth step is that if it's determined that it is time, when the time comes in each area to amend the protocols for services and other group gatherings, then the pastor, after consulting with the leadership, outlines, he gets all the input, and then he checks back again with the leadership and the congregation and says, here's what I'm thinking of doing. Any further comments? And so we're going pretty, you know, serious step by step. And then the fifth step, we submit our plan. The pastor submits the plan, and we actually have a form we need to go through to ministerial services in McKinney, Texas, and to get their approval of our personal or our individual plan for that individual congregation. So that's the process. I think it's pretty thorough, and I think it's the concept is to be out ahead of the game and have a plan in place rather than have suddenly circumstances change, and then we say, oh, now what do we do? Now what do we do? So this, it's not, you can't use it yet. This isn't happening next week. But as far as I know, in any congregations, I don't know that any of us, any congregations are to that stage yet. But the bottom line is, at least this will be a plan put in place so that once we're ready to begin to move, we know exactly we'll have a unified approach to it within the church, even though it won't be a unified approach as, well, this church now has, they're able to go back to this status, or they can do that, or the other. Well, this church, you know, we still have, as Mr. Franks noted in Accord last night, there are still countries or segments of countries that are on lockdown. We still have not been able to return to our Canadian visits. The border is still closed. And they're dealing up there with most of their new cases in Ontario and Quebec now are this British variant, they're calling it, the new variant of COVID. So that's what they're dealing with. So that's the general outline. I thought I would mention that to you and just give you a bit of the announcement first and then the summary. Again, this is not on the verge of happening that I know of in many areas, if any, chiefly due to continuing directives, restrictions, and mandates. And again, some countries and areas, our brethren still are not able to meet. or they can with great restrictions. For example, I know that in Montreal, Mr. Harper had a situation where there was a curfew in place. And the curfew was, I think, 8 o'clock in the evening, and then just days before the Passover, it was shifted to 9:30, which gave them just enough time to go through the Passover service and have everybody get home before the curfew hit. And so those things are interesting when they occur, when we can see a little bit of help coming. What this is a plan. It's not happening now, but it's a plan. It's a procedure to follow when the time comes. So that when that happens for each country or each area of the world or even individual church congregations, we will have a template, a plan to work from, to be as unified as it is possible to be in these strange circumstances. I'm sure we can all appreciate that a year and a half ago, at about, let's say, the Feast of Tabernacles in 2019, if anybody had told you what was going to happen in the last 18 months, we would have said, what? That doesn't even sound right. It doesn't even sound normal. How is that even possible in our advanced modern world? Well, I think we've come to face to face with the fact that we're not perhaps as advanced and modern as we think in some ways. And some of the old challenges of the past can rise up and surprise us again. But what it is, brethren, basically is what you might call an exit strategy. It's an exit strategy. And if you'll bear with me, I'd like to take something of a circuitous route to get to the spiritual application of that phrase for today's sermon, because I think when we look back at something we've just recently completed, it is only 1 week now since the Days of Unleavened Bread ended. There's perhaps more that we can still mine from that week of time as we go forward. I'd like to, first of all, go back a few years in our own U.S. history and examine the development of a phrase in our English language. That phrase, exit strategy. Where did it come from? What it means in common usage? And then we'll take a look at that phrase from our vantage point, being part of the Church of God and being only 1 week removed from the Days of Unleavened Bread. So to begin, we need to go back about 50 years to the early 1970s. You will notice that since I am beginning to teach a course in history beginning on Monday, I'm using you as guinea pigs. So I'm going to throw some history stuff at you. So please don't fall asleep. That would give a really bad feeling going into the classes beginning Monday. We've been running, trying to get ready for all this. My wife said last night, she said, you know, honey, I'm kind of, you know, this is challenging. She said, I hope I don't fall asleep in your first class on Monday. I hope so too. I hope so too. I've been warned already that the TV crew will be in the classroom that day getting what they call B-roll to use on some of the In Accord productions. So if she starts nodding, I'm just going to point to the TV cameraman and we'll see what happens. So I am practicing on you. You are guinea pigs today. Where were we as a nation about 50 years ago? For some, you might remember. For others, you're going to say, well, tell me about it because I have no idea. We were embroiled in what had become a very unpopular war, the war in Vietnam. It began very quietly for the United States, clear back in the 50s. In 1956, President Dwight Eisenhower started sending what were called American advisors to the area that was formerly called French Indochina when it was part of a colony of France to train South Vietnamese soldiers. There was a communist takeover of the northern provinces of Vietnam. It was they were known as the Viet Minh, M-I-N-H, named after their leader, Ho Chi Minh. And they had driven the French out in 1954, incursions from the north, from China. But by the time John Kennedy became president, January of 1961, the numbers of those advisors had increased slightly over those 5 years. They continued to grow during his short presidency, which, of course, was tragically terminated with his death by assassination in November of 1963. After President Lyndon Johnson took over following the assassination, an incident occurred that changed the direction of American involvement. And this is the kind of thing that when you don't expect it and you react in a certain way, things can go in a pattern you didn't expect to go. North Vietnamese forces fired on U.S. warships that were on patrol in what was called the Gulf of Tonkin. It was an arm of the South China Sea just off the Vietnamese coast. Congress authorized the president to take whatever military steps he considered necessary to defend U.S. troops, even without Congress declaring war. That was different. Korea had been an undeclared war as well, and some back in those days called it a police action. Of course, the soldiers who were there said, then why don't they send the police instead of us? But that's the way it was. In 1965, the first land combat troops from the United States arrived in Vietnam. Over the next 3 years, the numbers escalated rapidly. By 1968, the war had become so unpopular, and eventually over 58,000 U.S. servicemen lost their lives, that President Johnson declared he would not be a candidate for re-election in 1968. He could have run again, even though he had served one full term, because he had only served out a minority of President Kennedy's term. He would have been allowed by the Constitution to run again if he had chosen to. In the election of 1968, Republican Richard Nixon narrowly defeated the Democratic candidate Hubert Humphrey and became president in January of 1969. By 1973, weary of the war that seemed never ending in the nation, President Nixon engineered a ceasefire. At the time, it was called peace with honor, but the fighting never really stopped. But the whispering in the halls of the military and the Pentagon had already been happening for a while. The career military said they invented a new phrase to describe the situation. The administration, they said, had no exit strategy. They had no exit strategy for how to get out of the quagmire that the war had become. By 1975, the last U.S. troops were airlifted out from Saigon. And shortly thereafter, the government of South Vietnam collapsed and capitulated, and the entire country was taken over by the forces from North Vietnam. And now it's just simply known as Vietnam once again. The phrase exit strategy was really, at that time, still just kind of the jargon and lingo of the military professionals. It was just an in-house term. But about not quite 20 years later, the public came to understand it because it began to be used again in the wake of another U.S. military debacle. This one was in Mogadishu, Somalia. There was a terrible loss of life and dislocation of Somali citizens in a civil war in the early 90s, late 1992. President George H.W. Bush, or as he's sometimes known, Bush 41, sent U.S. servicemen to Kenya to try to help more than 500,000 displaced Somalis. But by the following spring, in 1993, there was a new president in the White House. Bill Clinton was president, took office in January of 93. Then he came under fire in his policies when 8 U.S. troops were killed in backing up a UN peacekeeping mission. It was the Battle of Mogadishu, as it was called, became known in popular culture as Black Hawk Down. Some of you may have heard that. They even made a movie about it. 2 U.S. Black Hawk helicopters were shot down by Somali partisans, and pictures of the stripped bodies of U.S. servicemen being dragged through the streets of Mogadishu were broadcast around the world. 1993. President Clinton, his critics said, had no exit strategy on how to get free from the mess. Unfortunately, he faced criticism later on when the U.S. became involved in some of the Yugoslav wars, with UN peacekeeping missions being sent to Bosnia, Kosovo, and Serbia in the mid-90s. By now, the phrase had come into general use, and most of you have probably heard of it many times, exit strategy. The definition is that an exit strategy is a means of escaping your current situation, typically an unfavorable one. It can be an organization or an individual. The person without an exit strategy could be in a quagmire. It's like quicksand. How do you get out? At worst, an exit strategy is an attempt to save face. At best, it could peg a withdrawal to the achievement of an objective that's worth more than it would cost to continue the mess you're in, the involvement. Now they use the term in business. Businesses use the term. Do you have an exit strategy? How do you plan to implement this? How do you plan to do this? But it began as a military term. At worst, it basically means cut your losses and run. At best, though, best case scenario, you can get out of a bad situation by pursuing a goal that's a better one than you had before and worth more than what you were doing before. That's the one you and I want to think about. And that's where I want to bring it around to a biblical focus. Do you know of any situations in the Bible where situations were there and God's people or leaders or converted Christians were in a mess and a quagmire and trying to figure out how to get out of it? Well, the Bible's filled with them, isn't it? It's directly connected to the season we just finished a week ago. So we're already on the way toward Pentecost because the first holy day fell on the first day of the week this year on a Sunday. We're actually 2 weeks counting toward Pentecost. 5 weeks from tomorrow is Pentecost. But turn back to Exodus chapter 3. And let's look once more at some of the lessons from ancient Israel to start the day. Exodus chapter 3. In verse 1 it says, "Now Moses was tending the flock of Jethro his father-in-law, the priest of Midian. And he led the flock to the back of the desert and came to Horeb, the mountain of God. And the angel of the Eternal appeared to him in a flame of fire from the midst of a bush." Generally speaking, when you see that term, and the word angel is capitalized, and we generally believe, we just think that in most cases that actually is a reference to the one who became Jesus Christ, to the Logos, the pre-existent or the pre-revealed Jesus Christ, the one who became our Savior later. "He appeared to him in a flame of fire from the midst of a bush. So he looked, and behold, the bush was burning with fire, but it wasn't consumed. Then Moses said, 'I'll turn aside now and see this great sight, why the bush doesn't burn.' So when the Lord saw that he turned aside to look, God called to him from the midst of the bush and said, 'Moses, Moses.' And he said, 'Here I am.' Then he said, 'Do not draw near this place. Take your sandals off your feet, for the place where you stand is holy ground. And moreover,' he said, 'I am the God of your father, the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob.' And Moses hid his face, for he was afraid to look on God. And the Eternal said, 'I have surely seen the oppression of my people who are in Egypt, and I've heard their cry because of their taskmasters, for I know their sorrows. So I've come down to deliver them out of the hand of the Egyptians, and to bring them up from that land to a large and good land, to a land flowing with milk and honey, to the place of the Canaanites and the Hittites and the Amorites, Perizzites, Hivites, Jebusites. Now therefore, behold, the cry of the children of Israel has come to me, and I have seen the oppression with which the Egyptians oppressed them. Come now, therefore, and I will send you to Pharaoh, that you may bring my people, the children of Israel, out of Egypt." So this is the first hint Moses has of a direct involvement by God, at least the first that we know of. God tells Moses that he knows the situation his people are in. He knows the situations we're in too, as I'm sure we can appreciate. He knew about the quagmire of their slavery to the Egyptians. It may have started slowly, as we found in the earliest chapter of Exodus, chapter 1, when it began, but it quickly snowballed out of control for the Israelites themselves. He outlines basically what we would call an exit strategy to Moses. Wouldn't you call it that? He basically said, Moses, this is my plan in very general terms. This is what I intend to do. Details to follow, I guess you'd say. Of course, as it happened, it didn't go nearly as quickly or as smoothly as Moses seemed to think it would. Now, you can understand, can't you? God speaks to him and says, Moses, I know what my people are going through. I see what's happening. I am going to deliver them. And what would your reaction be? Be terrific. Wonderful. By this time next week, you know, I don't think so. Because we come down to chapter 5 after some of the initial explanations and the advice that Aaron could help him, the fact that his wife and sons turned back and didn't continue to Egypt with him late in chapter 4. In chapter 5, afterwards, after they'd spoken to the elders and the leaders of the people, Moses and Aaron went and told Pharaoh, thus says the Lord God of Israel, let my people go that they may hold a feast to me in the wilderness. Now, from their perspective, that was perfectly reasonable. They knew who they were talking about. God, who could do anything. And Pharaoh said, who is this Lord? Who is this, you know, ever-living one? He's the one. So it's another God. We've got lots of gods in Egypt. That I shall obey his voice to let Israel go. I do not know the Lord, nor will I let Israel go. So they said, the God of the Hebrews has met with us. That's who we're talking about. They tried to fill him in. Please let us go 3 days' journey into the desert and sacrifice to the Lord our God, lest he fall upon us with pestilence or with the sword. That wasn't going to cut it either with Pharaoh. Then the king of Egypt said to them, Moses and Aaron, why do you take the people from their work? Get back to your labor. Go back to work. And Pharaoh said, look, the people of the land are many now, and you're making them rest from their labor. So the same day, Pharaoh commanded the taskmasters of the people and their officers, saying, you shall no longer give the people straw to make brick as before. Let them go and gather straw for themselves. And you'll lay on them the quota of bricks which they made before. It shall not be reduced. They're idle. That's why they're crying out, saying, let us go and sacrifice to our God. A typical crunch down by the tyrannical authority that was Pharaoh. Let more work be laid on the men that they may labor in it, and let them not regard false words. So the taskmasters went out, spoke to the people. Here's what Pharaoh says. I won't give you straw, but you can't reduce your quota. Not good. Drop down to verse 19. And the officers of the children of Israel saw that they were in trouble after it was said, you shall not reduce any bricks from your daily quota. Then as they came out from Pharaoh, they met Moses and Aaron who stood there to meet them. And they said to them, let the Lord look on you and judge, because you have made us abhorrent in the sight of Pharaoh and in the sight of his servants to put a sword in their hand to kill us. So Moses returned to the Lord and said, Lord, why have you brought trouble to this people, on this people? Do you see what happens? Why is it you've sent me? For since I came to Pharaoh to speak in your name, he has done evil to this people, neither have you delivered your people at all. Now you can understand in a physical sense where Moses was coming from. He felt like he was in an impossible situation. These were the instructions, and it seemed so clear when God spoke to him from the burning bush. But now what? Things are worse than ever before. If anything, the quicksand was getting stickier. It was getting worse, not better. Chapter 6, God reassures Moses. The Lord said to Moses, you'll see what I will do to Pharaoh. For with a strong hand he will let them go, and with a strong hand he will drive them out of this land, or his land. God spoke to Moses and said, I am the eternal, the ever-living one. That's the Tetragrammaton, YHVH or YHWH. I appeared to Abraham, to Isaac, to Jacob as God Almighty, but by my name Eternal, or YHVH, I was not known to them. This was a different aspect. I have also established my covenant with them to give them the land of Canaan, the land of their pilgrimage in which they were strangers. And I've heard the groanings of the children of Israel, whom the Egyptians keep in bondage, and I have remembered my covenant. He has basically said, I've not forgotten anything. Nothing's changed, Moses. Therefore, say to the children of Israel, I am the Eternal, the ever-living one. I will bring you out from the burdens of the Egyptians. I will rescue you from their bondage, and I will redeem you with an outstretched arm and great judgments. I will take you as my people, and I will be your God. Do you hear the overtones of what would be the key part of the new covenant, Jeremiah 31? Then you shall know that I am the Eternal, your God, who brings you out from under the burdens of the Egyptians. And I will bring you into the land which I swore to give to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. And I will give it to you as a heritage. I am the Eternal. I am the Lord. So Moses spoke thus to the people, but they didn't heed Moses because of anguish of spirit and cruel bondage. It's hard to see out of troubles when you're in the midst of them. It's hard to see out of it. The old saying is, it's tough to remember that your original intent was to drain the swamp when you're up to your hips in alligators, you know. Mixing my metaphors a little bit. Although I suppose there could have been alligators or crocodiles somewhere in Egypt back at that time. In chapter 7, God gives Moses some more detail. Now he adds a little bit to the understanding Moses had. You know, he doesn't always let us see everything he's doing all at once, does he? It isn't always immediately apparent just what steps God might take to deliver his people. Chapter 7, verse 1, the Lord said to Moses, see, I have made you as God to Pharaoh, and Aaron your brother will be your prophet. You'll speak all that I command you, and Aaron your brother will tell Pharaoh to send the children of Israel out of his land, and I will harden Pharaoh's heart. Now that was something new. I will harden Pharaoh's heart and multiply my signs and my wonders in the land of Egypt. It would work out in a way God knew was best. It would leave no question about where the power truly was. Not with the gods, so-called gods of Egypt, but with the only real God. But, he says, here's just a heads up, Moses, Pharaoh will not heed you. That must have been discouraging. So that I may lay my hand on Egypt and bring my armies and my people, the children out of Israel, out of the land of Egypt by great judgments. God says, I have something else in mind, Moses. You don't always see all the details of what I'm working out. And the Egyptians shall know that I am the Eternal, the ever-living one. When I stretch out my hand on Egypt and bring out the children of Israel from among them. And Moses and Aaron did so, just as the Lord commanded them, so they did. They had a little more understanding now. They were not quitting on God. They just cried out in anguish. I'm sure you and I can appreciate that sometimes. It doesn't mean we're quitting on God. But haven't you ever cried out in the midst of a trial, Father, please, I don't understand. Why is this not going away? Why is it not modifying? And Moses was 80 years old, and Aaron 83 years old when they spoke to Pharaoh. Miriam, we assume, the sister must have been older because she was old enough, for example, to oversee what was happening when Moses was floating in the reeds and Pharaoh's daughter rescued him. So this is how things were going. God explains a little bit more of the exit strategy to Moses. By now, Moses was learning a little more in detail. This might take some time. There were an unspecified number at this point of judgments on Egypt. There was the warning, Pharaoh won't listen to you. And yet you have to go on. And so the 10 plagues came on Egypt. I'm not going to go through too much more detail with this part of it for now. But the exit strategy still wasn't complete. Yes, they left their conditions of slavery. It says in chapter 14 and verse 8, it says, "The Eternal hardened the heart of Pharaoh, king of Egypt." This was after they had already left. Chapter 14, they're gone. "And he pursued the children of Israel." The children of Israel went out with boldness. I think the old King James said they went out with a high hand. I don't know if that means the equivalent back at that time of high-fiving it all the way out of Egypt. I don't know. But that's what had happened. And yet, it wasn't over yet, was it? Now they were free, they thought. And can you imagine what would it have been like if you had been the first Israelite to spot a little bit of dust behind you and realize eventually what it was, the Egyptian army? You know, just beginning the journey wasn't the same thing as being done with Egypt. Verse 9, "The Egyptians pursued them, all the horses and chariots of Pharaoh, his horsemen, his army, and they overtook them camping by the sea." Uh-oh. "And when Pharaoh drew near, the children of Israel lifted their eyes, and behold, the Egyptians marched after them. They were very afraid, and they cried out to the Lord." And look at what they said to Moses. "Because there weren't any graves in Egypt, have you taken us away to die in the wilderness? Why have you so dealt with us to bring us up out of Egypt? Isn't this what we said in Egypt? We said, leave us alone so we can serve the Egyptians." Go and try to find that phrase back in the earlier chapters of Exodus. Try to find where that's recorded. All I know is it isn't recorded. And isn't it funny how we as humans can reinvent our history sometimes? It would have been better for us to serve the Egyptians than to die in the wilderness. Better a dead, you know, a live slave than a dead free man, they might have said. Moses said to the people, "Don't be afraid. Stand still and see the salvation of the Lord, which he will accomplish for you today. The Egyptians whom you see today, you will see again no more forever. The Eternal will fight for you, and you will hold your peace," or hold your tongue. And that's what happened. That was God's exit strategy. You read the rest of chapter 14, and it worked exactly as God had intended. Verse 15, "The Lord said to Moses, 'Why do you cry to me? Tell the children of Israel to go forward.'" And they must have looked and said, "Forward is into the drink. I can't swim that well." "Lift up your rod, stretch your hand over the sea and divide it. The children of Israel will go on dry ground through the midst of the sea." Astonishing. He can see things we can't see. Not easy, is it? Read the rest of chapter 14 in your own studies. The Bible is filled with examples of God working out his exit strategy in the lives of his people. Turn to 2 Kings 18. How about another famous one? Second Kings 18, verse 1, "It came to pass in the third year of Hoshea the son of Elah, king of Israel, that Hezekiah the son of Ahaz, king of Judah, began to reign. He was 25 years old when he became king, and he reigned 29 years in Jerusalem. His mother's name was Abi, the daughter of Zechariah. He did what was right in the sight of the Eternal according to all that his father David had done. He removed the high places, and he broke the sacred pillars, cut down the wooden image, and he even broke in pieces the bronze serpent that Moses had made, for until those days the children of Israel had burned incense to it and called it Nehushtan, which was the name of a Canaanite goddess." Literally, it translates to bronze thing, but it was they named it after a Canaanite goddess. "He trusted in the Lord God of Israel, so that after him was none like him among all the kings of Judah, nor who were before him. For he held fast to the Lord. He did not depart from following him, but kept his commandments, which the Lord had commanded Moses. The Lord was with him. He prospered wherever or whenever he went. And he rebelled against the king of Assyria and did not serve him. He subdued the Philistines as far as Gaza and its territory, from watchtower to fortified city. So this is a great start. The true worship of God is being restored. False worship is being rooted out. Some enemies are even being subdued. But, you know, things are not always smooth sailing, even when they look that way, are they, sometimes? You ever notice that yourself? You ever have the sense that while nothing is sort of overtly wrong, you know, we use the phrase, I just can't put my finger on it. I don't know exactly what it is. In a spiritual sense, you're still moving, it seems to you, too slowly. Not like with the exuberance of being at the feast, maybe, or the absolute relief and joy it is to come forward to the Passover every year. Perhaps settling into some sort of quickstand you can't quite see yet. It happened to Hezekiah. Pick it up in verse 9. It came to pass in the fourth year of the king, which was the seventh year of Hoshea the son of Elah, king of Israel, that Shalmaneser, king of Assyria, came up against Samaria and besieged. Now, this is the neighboring country to your north. You're Hezekiah, king of Judah, the southern kingdom. Now you're hearing reports that just to your north, the Assyrians are attacking the house of Israel. At the end of 3 years, they took it. Generally, we think of that as 721 to 718 BC in history, the fall of the northern kingdom of Israel. In the sixth year of Hezekiah, that is, the ninth year of Hoshea, king of Israel, Samaria was taken. Then the king of Assyria carried Israel away captive to Assyria. He installed them in these cities. You'll find in some of the other references and chronicles, it talks about how he took other captive peoples and shuffled them around from some of his other conquests and put them in Samaria. And so by Christ's day, the Samaritans were not Israelites at all. Because they didn't obey the voice of the Lord their God, that's why, transgressed his covenant, all that Moses, the servant of the Lord, had commanded, and would neither hear nor do them. Now you think, okay, well, that's happening to your north. It's a little troubling. Now what? In the 14th year of King Hezekiah, Sennacherib, king of Assyria, came up against all the fortified cities of Judah and took them. Now the Assyrians are knocking at the door of Jerusalem. Then Hezekiah, king of Judah, sent to the king of Assyria, who was at Lachish. My wife and I have been there. We walked up the ramp to the top of the ruins and the remains on the hill. As old societies, you know, they'd tear down one and build on top of it, build on top of it, and the mound grew higher and higher. We could see the siege mound was still there from the Assyrian attacks in the late 8th century B.C. And he sends to Assyria. His first direct threat, what did he do? Well, did he turn to God immediately? Even as righteous as he was, he did not. He sent to the king of Assyria at Lachish and said, I'm sorry. I've offended you somehow. I've done wrong. Turn away from me. Whatever you impose on me, I will pay. And the king of Assyria assessed Hezekiah 300 talents of silver and 30 talents of gold. So where did he find it? He gave him all the silver in the house of the Eternal and in the treasuries of the king's house. He stripped the gold from the doors of the temple and from the pillars which Hezekiah, king of Judah, had overlaid, and gave it to the king of Assyria. How do you think that's going to work? How often in history does appeasing a territory-hungry tyrant work, bent on conquest? Not very often. History tells us it just doesn't want. They just want more. So, verse 31, what happens? Now, they're coming up against the gates of Jerusalem. And the commander of the Assyrian army says in the hearing of those on the wall, don't listen to Hezekiah. For thus says the king of Assyria, make peace with me by a present, and come out to me by paying tribute, margin has. And every one of you will eat from his own vine, and every one from his own fig tree. I'll leave you in peace. How does that work out? And every one of you will drink the waters of his own cistern, until I come and take you away to a land just like your own. A land of grain and new wine, a land of bread and vineyards, a land of olive groves and honey, that you may live and not die. But don't listen to Hezekiah, because he'll try to persuade you, saying, the Lord will deliver us. You can almost hear him kind of snorting and saying, has any of the gods of the nations at all delivered its land from the hand of the king of Assyria? Where are the gods of Hamath and Arpad? Where are the gods of, and he just lists his conquests. Indeed, have they delivered Samaria from my hand, your brother nation? Who among all the gods of the lands have delivered their countries from my hand that the Lord should deliver Jerusalem? Well, they held their peace because that's what they were told to do. In chapter 19, Hezekiah turns to God. He's verse 1 of chapter 19. When Hezekiah heard it, he tore his clothes, covered himself with sackcloth, went into the house of the Lord. This is where you and I need to turn for an exit strategy. This is where you get the power you need. Notice how when he received the letter in verse 14 from the messengers, he went up to the house of God and he spread it out before God. Now, it's not that God couldn't read it unless Hezekiah did that, but it was a dramatic acknowledgement of where he was appealing for help. And he spread. Then Hezekiah prayed, Lord God of Israel, the one who dwells between the cherubim, you are God, you alone of all the kingdoms of the earth. You've made heaven and earth. Incline your ear and hear. Open your eyes and see. Hear the words of Sennacherib that he has sent to reproach you, the living God. Truly, the kings of Assyria have laid waste the nations and their lands, and they've cast their gods into the fire because they weren't gods. They were just the work of men's hands, wood and stone. So they destroyed them. Now, God, the Lord our God, save us from his hand, that all the kingdoms of the earth may know that you are the Lord God, you alone. And Isaiah, the prophet, sends word, says, God has heard you. God has heard you. And as you follow it through to the end of the chapter, you'll find that God fought the battle for them. The surrounding Assyrian armies just didn't wake up the next morning. 185,000 dead Assyrian troops surrounding the city. The king fled to Nineveh, and later, and the time frame is not given here, but other histories will point out it was actually some years later, he was assassinated by his own sons. God took care of it. On the spiritual level, how does it work in the lives of individuals? This was a nation. Well, you know, we have lots of experiences, lots of examples of that. We heard very recently in a sermon from Mr. Pavlik, a very famous example of a servant of God who had to turn to God for something he couldn't understand at the time. Remember his sermon, March 27th, just before the days of unleavened bread began, on Job? And the things that Job had to learn. He was a righteous man. He was a righteous man. Even Satan had to admit he was righteous to God. And yet, did he see everything he needed to see? Does any human being? Do you? Do I? We don't always see, brethren, the way we need to. We know the terrible trials and troubles of the man Job. And yet, as you look through parts of his story, knowing that he cannot and must not turn from obeying God, one of the most amazing references is in the very first chapter of Job in verse 22. It says, in all this, Job did not sin or charge God with wrong. But he certainly came to a point later where he cried out in agony and pain because he didn't understand. When you come to chapter 9, the very points Mr. Pavlik was raising, we aren't big enough. We aren't strong enough. We aren't smart enough. Only God has those things that we need. And in Job 9 and verse 21, you read these words and it's just almost agonizing. He said, I am blameless. He's evaluated. He said, I know I haven't violated your law. His three friends kept trying to tell him, well, you must have sinned somewhere. Just repent and get it over with. And Job said, that's not the issue. I'm blameless, but look at this. Yet I don't know myself. I mean, I'm not aware of anything I'm doing wrong. I despise my life. This is tough. This is an awful trial. It's all one thing. Therefore, in his moments of despair, I say he destroys the blameless and the wicked. That didn't make sense to him. It didn't make sense at all. Chapter, verse 27. If I say, I'll forget my complaint. I will put off my sad face and wear a smile. But then I'm afraid of all my sufferings. I know that you won't hold me innocent. If there's something I'm doing wrong, I need to know. It's no good pretending. That won't solve anything or get to the heart of the matter. Not that we all want to come to services every Sabbath with long faces or unnecessarily dump on others. We knew of she inside, in at her core, she was a really sweet, sweet older lady in our very first assignment we ever had many, many years ago. She was an old Scots lady, and she just believed in saying it like it was. And if you'd say, well, how are you today, Mrs. So-and-so? She'd say, rotten, thanks, how are you? But if you got to know her, there was a soft, mushy heart in there somewhere. Well, Job was saying, you know, I can't just pretend. It's not going to go away. It's the message, really, of the days of unleavened bread sometimes, isn't it? We're a week clear now. What about us? Do we have an exit strategy? Do you have an exit strategy? When things just, somehow they don't seem quite right, what's your recourse? Where do you turn? Where do you look? We know from reading the rest of the book of Job, for example, we've heard the end of the story. We know how it all worked out. We heard that Job came to see, we saw and we read it, that though he was a faithful servant of God, there were still things to learn. He wasn't big enough. He wasn't strong enough. He wasn't smart enough. Only God had those things. He needed to see and understand even more things, more clearly. And he did by the end of the book. It's an astonishing testament. You know, this is one of the men that he's spoken of in the prophets by saying, though Noah, Daniel, and Job were in it, they would deliver only their own souls by their righteousness. That's a pretty, you know, elite group to be listed in, though Noah, Daniel, and Job were in it. And he learned. For them, the aha experience. He said, I've heard of you by the hearing of the ear, but now my eye sees you. And he had an exit strategy. He had an exit strategy. And it worked. God did show Job the way out of his trials. He did give him the exit strategy he needed. And most of it involved helping Job see him more clearly. And see that in comparison to the great God of the universe, no human measures up. No matter how dedicated, no matter how obedient, no matter how righteous. It worked. We probably should consider one more example before we leave the concept even of the days of unleavened bread behind us. And that's ourselves. How did we start this process? Mr. Franks mentioned in his letter recently, and he mentioned it again last night on In Accord. That's when we watched it anyway. Of reviewing and evaluating and sort of taking stock every year. And he especially said he wanted to focus this year on relationships. Relationships. And I'm sure that every one of us started that same process, and we probably began with the same verse that many of us use every year in 2 Corinthians 13 and verse 5. Examine yourselves, Paul wrote to the church at Corinth, as to whether you're in the faith. Test yourselves. Do you not know yourselves that Jesus Christ is in you? Unless indeed you are disqualified. But I trust, he said, you will know that we are not disqualified. I'm guessing just about every one of us read this verse, meditated on it, asked God to help us head into that special season of the year just a few weeks ago now in a right manner before him. And we know we need him to do that for us. Turn back to Isaiah 55 and take a look at some things we all have had to learn. Isaiah 55, verse 6. Seek the Lord while he may be found. Call upon him while he's near. Let the wicked forsake his way, and the unrighteous man his thoughts. Let him return to the Lord, and he will have mercy on him, and to our God, and he will abundantly pardon. For my thoughts are not your thoughts. You know, you go back to the example of Moses that we were looking at in a little more detail earlier. We can see it in spades there, can't we? It's so obvious. It's so clear to us. Moses is told in front of the burning bush, this is what I'm going to do. And he leaves thinking, this is great. This is wonderful. And then all of a sudden, the first time he goes to Pharaoh, it gets worse. They're told, you have to make just as many bricks, but I'm not going to give you straw. And he even went to God and says, you haven't delivered us at all. But then God began to fill in more of the details. And he said, Moses, this is what I plan. I know he won't listen to you. I want you to go back to him, and I want you to tell him what's going to happen, and he won't listen to you. How's that for a send-off? Here is your project. It is guaranteed to fail. Oh, brother. And yet, Moses had a better view then. He had a wider picture. My thoughts are not your thoughts, nor are your ways my ways, says the Lord. As the heavens are higher than the earth, so are my ways higher than your ways, my thoughts than your thoughts. As the rain comes down and the snow from heaven, and they don't return there, but they water the earth and make it bring forth and bud, that it might give seed to the sower and bread to the eater, so shall my word be that goes forth from my mouth. It will not return to me void. It will accomplish what I please and prosper in the thing for which I sent it. You will go out with joy, be led out with peace. The mountains and hills shall break forth into singing before you. And the trees of the field will clap their hands. He begins to recite the prophet Isaiah of the future that God has in mind. Can we see that? Can we look ahead? Can we understand the thing for which he sent it? And be looking for that day. You and I need an exit strategy to use the analogy to get out of Egypt and stay out of Egypt no less than the ancient Israelites did. Jeremiah knew something about that too. Jeremiah chapter 10. Jeremiah 10 verses 23 and 24. O Lord, I know the way of man is not in himself. It's not in man who walks to direct his own steps. We don't have the answers. We have to rely on God for them. Whatever he says is what we should be doing. Lord, correct me, but with justice. Not in your anger, lest you bring me to nothing. And the Bible is very revealing about some of its key people and heroes. Those wonderful words from Jeremiah. But then look at verse 25. If you're going to get mad at somebody, he says, pour out your fury on the Gentiles who don't know you. And on the families who don't call on your name, they've eaten up Jacob, devoured and consumed him, and made his dwelling place desolate. But he did say, I know this. I know I have to turn to you, so please correct me, but be gentle. Be gentle. He knew who had to give the exit strategy. Brethren, isn't that one of the most crucial lessons we should have learned and could have learned from the days of unleavened bread in 2021? By now, I must confess to you, I have had my first apple fritter since the days of unleavened bread are over. True time for true confession. And it tasted just as good as I thought it would. Trouble was, it was too big and I had to eat it in three helpings. I just can't do what I used to do anymore. But the lessons need to stay with us. We too need a way out of Egypt. We too need to understand that sometimes we think we have it clearly identified, just like Moses did. Okay, this is what's going to happen. And then he goes, marches into Pharaoh and says, "You got to let us go. Otherwise, God will punish us." And Pharaoh said, "I don't know who this God is." And they said, "Well, he's the God of the Hebrews." "I don't know who that is." "Just go. Get out of here. And by the way, you're going to have to provide your own straw. You're too lazy. You're idle. Otherwise, there's none of this nonsense talk about going into the desert and leaving Egypt." And Moses was flattened for a temporary time period. Life throws us some unexpected curves, doesn't it? Like a worldwide pandemic, for example. We too can sometimes approach the Red Sea metaphorically and find ourselves trapped. And find that we can't rely on our own strength to spring us free. It's just not going to work. That we too find that only God can part the sea of our challenges and trials and sometimes sins. Turn to Hebrews chapter 12. Hebrews 12, verse 1. "Therefore," and you know what chapter this follows. Chapter 11 is the faith chapter with all these amazing examples. "Therefore, we also, since we are surrounded by so great a cloud of witnesses, let us lay aside every weight and the sin which so easily ensnares us." There's that analogy again. "Let us run with endurance the race that is set before us." This is not a sprint. This is a marathon. "And looking to Jesus, the author and finisher of our faith, who for the joy that was set before him endured the cross, despising the shame, and has sat down at the right hand of the throne of God." And then it goes on to say, consider what he went through. And consider the fact that God will intervene and sometimes, yes, even chasten those of his children whom he loves. Earlier in the book, in chapter 3 of Hebrews, there's a reference to the experience of the Israelites. At the end of chapter 3, it says in verse 16, "Who, having heard, rebelled? Wasn't it all who came out of Egypt led by Moses?" Hebrews 3:16. "With whom was he angry 40 years? Wasn't it with those who sinned, whose corpses fell in the wilderness? To whom did he swear they would not enter his rest, but those who didn't obey?" We see they couldn't enter in because of unbelief, lack of faith. And then he tells us, he says, "A promise remains of entering his rest. Let us fear lest any of you seem to have come short." He says the problem was they heard the message, but they didn't understand it, and it wasn't mixed with faith. What about us? What about us? There's a connection in their experience to ancient Israel. The one with the answers and the path to walk assures us that there's a future. Hebrews 4:9 says, "There remains therefore a rest for the people of God." That is applicable on so many levels. So many levels. Verse 14 says, "Seeing then," Hebrews 4:14, "that we have a great high priest who has passed through the heavens, Jesus, the Son of God, let us hold fast our confession," or profession. We don't have a high priest who can't sympathize with our weaknesses. He was tempted in all points as we are, but without sin. "So come boldly before the throne of grace to obtain mercy and grace to help in time of need." This strategy works. It will work for you. It will work for me. It's worked for God's servants in every age. We don't always see all the details early on. But it works. And the future is what we're looking toward. A week ago, the sun went down on the last day of Unleavened Bread. The days of Unleavened Bread for 2021 are history. But you know, we worked so hard to get ready for that week. In some ways, the preparations for the spring feasts are you know, gigantic. We cleaned our homes and our offices and our vehicles. We were careful so that we got the leaven out. It felt so good, doesn't it? It's almost a physical feeling when the last bag of trash is off the property. You almost want to dance a little jig, you know, out in the street. And of course, if your neighbors see you and ask what's going on, I just got rid of all the yeast, all the sin. What? That's not going to work. Someday they'll understand. But have we gleaned some spiritual lessons? Do we have the same joy in obedience to God and seeking His ways and drawing closer to Him and studying His Word to access more the mind of His Son, the one who unselfishly gave His life? That's what started the process. Let's not forget the important spiritual lessons of all of this that God wants us to have reinforced every year. It's why we do it again and again and again. Sin is tough to get out. It invades every area of our lives, just like leaven finds its way in just about every nook and cranny of our homes, it seems. Well, maybe not quite, but we need a way out. But let's remember who has the exit strategy to lead us where we need to be. Let's take a look at Moses and King Hezekiah and Job and learn the lessons that they did. We don't have to stay mired in the quicksand. We can come out. Let's reach out, take hold of the powerful helping hand He offers us, and escape with His exit strategy. And by the way, part of that involves looking forward. 5 weeks from tomorrow is Pentecost.